there, and welcome back to Preoccupied. Today we're going to be talking to licensed counselor and therapist Andrea Broadwater.
So because our interview with Ms. Broadwater was so filled with awesome questions and answers and ran so far over time, we're going to need to split this off into two episodes. So this is going to be part one of our interview with Ms. Broadwater. And next time when we come back, it'll be with part two.
So, Zenon, we all have this idea of what therapy looks like in our heads, but what isn't therapy? Let's get rid of all the speculation. What isn't therapy?
Yeah, there are definitely some things that can have almost therapeutic effects, and people might think that they can call those therapy, but really it's not the same process. Like, remember back in our abnormal psychology textbook, they gave this wonderful example of a hotel that was being demolished, and they offered people the chance to pay and come have the therapeutic experience of taking a sledgehammer to everything in a hotel room and absolutely destroying it.
Yeah. And while that does sound so fun and like a very expressive activity, it's not actually therapy. There's a few contingencies that makes one thing therapy and the other thing not exactly up to par with that definition.
Yeah, there are a few things that are definitely required for therapy to have its effectiveness.
So the first of that would be a sufferer, quote unquote, this is just what the definition says, who seeks relief from a healer.
Yeah, and this model comes out of famous research of a very important researcher whose name escapes me right now, but it will be in the show notes if you'd like to read it.
Always count on the show notes.
Yep, always.
And then the second part of that is that the healer must be trained. And they find a socially acceptable way to deal with the sufferings of the sufferer. And through a series of contexts, the healer produces certain changes in the sufferer's emotional state, attitudes, and/or behavior. So while like going to some abandoned hotel and like wrecking shit would be an awesome way to spend your average Tuesday, it's not actually therapy.
Yeah, because for one thing, there's no healer involved. So there's no psychologist, therapist, counselor, social worker, psychiatrist, what have you, involved there. And it's also not really a series of contacts because it occurs one time. Like, I doubt that you're going to return to this hotel room regardless of how helpful it's been to you.
Right. It's definitely would seem like a bucket list kind of activity to me.
Yeah.
And honestly, like, even like the socially accepted part, like, is a little iffy as well.
It is. Yeah. For good reason, we tend to frown upon wanton destruction. So.
Right. The destruction of property, especially the property that is not belonging to us. But, yes. You know, if you are going to do that, I would definitely seek out a place where that is sanctioned and appropriate and not go all like, I don't know, touring.
Or just enact your destructive urges on your own property and not someone else's.
That's right.
Yep.
Use your belongings how you see fit.
Exactly. Yeah, and that series of contacts is important because some researchers a while back defined a series of six steps or stages that are involved whenever you want to achieve some kind of emotional or behavioral change. And that's why the series of contacts is important, because it allows you to progress through those stages until you reach the point where the change is fully completed. And that's a lot of therapists, yeah, and a lot of therapists are trained in accordance with this model to be able to best help change occur in therapy. So it starts out with the pre-contemplation stage, where something's wrong, but you're not ready to change, you're not aware that you need to change, you're denying that there's even a problem, and maybe feeling overwhelmed by the consequences of whatever it is that needs to be changed.
So an example of this might be like your wife, I don't know, your wife, like really would like you to stop smoking. So you're thinking maybe you want to try talking to somebody about getting over this addiction. So you might be thinking, well, I like to smoke. I don't see why I need to change it. I've always smoked. And to move on in this first couple of sessions, a rude awakening might be the first step towards that change.
Yeah. And a lot of times until that rude awakening happens, you're not even likely to seek out a therapist because you're not thinking that anything's wrong.
So I guess in this case, your wife being like... Sorry if this is like personal for anybody, you know, but maybe somebody that you love saying, hey, I'm worried about you would be that rude awakening to have you seek out some help, which is when you'd enter into our second stage, the contemplation stage. So we had the pre-contemplation stage. Now we're in the thick of it. And you're aware that your actions have some consequences. You know, everybody kind of knows smoking isn't really great for you, and you're starting to think, okay, yeah, maybe it would be a good idea to change that, but I'm so busy right now, or like it's just not something that I could do. And like, in order to move on from this stage, the therapist's role in this stage might be to point out to you the consequences of not changing. So maybe talking about how, you know, your health could greatly suffer from this. Your friends and family are bothered by this habit, things like that.
Yeah, or maybe even focusing more so on the immediate consequences. Because if we ever get the chance to talk to someone who studies empathy or something like that, we're definitely going to get to talk about how your future self is often like a different person when it comes to visualizing the impact of things. So in therapy, the therapist would probably focus on like the immediate impacts as well. Like, okay, you're paying $6 a pack for cigarettes and smoking 2 packs a day. That's a lot of dollars by the end of the week that you're just throwing down the toilet. So what are you going to do about that?
Right.
So then the next stage is the preparation stage. So you've contemplated change and decided that, yeah, you know what? I got to change something. And you're preparing to enact that change within, like, at most within the next month. And you're looking at the cost and benefit of changing. So what would it involve? Time, money? Would you be losing pleasure of whatever you're changing away from? So like, this would be where the therapist would ask you to outline, okay, so on a monthly basis, how much are you spending on cigarettes now that you're not going to be spending any more on cigarettes? Okay, great. Now, what are some other consequences? Maybe you don't take a smoke break anymore at work. And so that's a cost in time. But maybe you could arrange to have a coffee break instead to mitigate that. And it just involves looking at like the at the details, at the specifics of what changing looks like.
Right. And then having this visualization or this kind of plan empowers the individual to get onto the next stage, which is the quote unquote take action stage. This is where you're actually trying out this change in behavior. In this case, you're cutting back or completely eliminating, if you can, cigarettes from your daily habits and seeing how that goes with the support of your therapist.
Yeah, and as you go through this, you know, maybe your original plan needs to change a bit.
Right, as you find what works for you.
Yeah. So, like, maybe going cold turkey isn't going to work out. And what you need to do is wean off. So even if that original plan changes, what matters is going through with the change and taking action on it. And then the next step is the maintenance stage, where you're working at it. And now that you've gone through with your plan, you're trying to maintain it. And you feel like a nice sense of satisfaction about what you've accomplished. But there's still some temptation to relapse and go back to time before the change.
Absolutely. But if you're able to get over that hump, that last bout of temptation, then you might see yourself entering the final stage, the termination stage, where you no longer feel tempted to relapse under any circumstances. When you're given same kind of prompts you would when you used to pick up a pack or whatever, you don't feel that same urge, and you've found that you've met your realistic goal.
Yeah. So the habit, the routine is just gone, and there's no longer a temptation to return to your unsavory behavior.
Yeah. And I feel like it's important to mention, like cigarettes is a good example just because it is so concrete, but a lot of things that people go to therapy for are a little bit less tangible, you know? So maybe your cigarettes is negative self-talk, and you kind of have to really work and like come up with a plan of sorts to like help change the way that you're thinking.
Yeah. And depending on the theoretical orientation of your therapist, how you're going to approach that might look different. So when we're talking about therapists and therapy, and in our future episodes in which we talk to different therapists, like we have a great one coming up pretty quick here with a psychodynamic psychoanalytic therapist. And
yes, we do.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, little plug there. But as we talk about all these different models and theoretical orientations, like what we mean by that is just the ideas that the treatments are founded on.
Right. It's like the lens that you look at a problem through.
Yeah, it's a way of thinking about abnormal psychological functioning that informs how that's treated. So when we talk to Ms. Broadwater a little bit later on, she identifies as a cognitive behavioral therapist, which comes from the cognitive and behavioral theoretical models. And the behavioral model, just because that kind of comes first in the history of psychology and thought about psychology. You know, it kind of started out with...
alphabetically.
Yes, this is true. You know, we started off with Freud and his psychoanalytic, psychodynamic, Oedipus complex, all of these things. And then we moved on and people started thinking, well, it's kind of hard to measure this psychodynamic, psychoanalytic theory. So they came up with behaviorism, which is the thought that any psychological functioning traces back to behavior. That when it comes down to it, when you look at someone, all you can really observe and know is their behavior. And when it comes to treating any kind of mental health issues, it focuses on tracking and changing behavior. So, Maddie, you want to tell us a bit about the cognitive model and how that thinks about psychology?
So, Zenon, we talked a little bit about cognition before, but in the context of therapy, what's meant by cognition is not just thoughts, but illogical thinking as kind of the foundation of a lot of symptoms of mental disorders. So in a way, that's like your mental framework of how you see things, how you deal with stress, things like that are all very... very cognitive based ideas.
Yeah. So like how you integrate your experience into your memory and your worldview, and kind of like if you're able to look at things rationally or if it's skewed in some way or another. So then, right. Yeah. So then when we talk about cognitive behavioral therapy, it combines ideas from the cognitive theory and the behavioral theory to form a style of treatment that looks at both illogical thinking patterns and problematic behavior habits, if you will, and kind of tackles those. So, Maddie, what are some of the methods by which a CBT therapist, cognitive behavioral therapy, no one ever actually says that. It's CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy.
Kind of a mouthful.
Yeah. There. Yeah. So how does a CBT therapist approach things?
So CBT is like pretty goal oriented, and it really looks at like your automatic thoughts, your assumptions about how you see like the things that you interact with every day. So something that a lot of cognitive behavioral therapists will do is have you do some homework, which hear me out. It kind of mixes with
homework.
For therapy, come on. And what this might look like is keeping a journal, something like that. And this is such a cool exercise just because you are able to reflect on your own thoughts and also have a behavior, you know, doing your homework that can be very therapeutic as well.
Yeah. So to kind of give an example of this, a cognitive behavioral therapy treatment for depression might look kind of like this. So you'd start off with the therapist asking you to make a list of activities that you enjoy or maybe enjoyed before the depression came on. And then your therapist would work with you to make a calendar or a planner that involves these activities that you enjoy to, you know, kind of try and elevate your mood through these behaviors. And then moving on, they would ask you to write down any negative automatic thoughts that you have. So, you know, thoughts that just come over you and, you know, reduce your mood, reinforce the depression, these kinds of things. And that would be your homework, is to take that and write them down in a journal and then bring them back to the sessions. And then the rest of the therapy is focused on like checking whether those thoughts are consistent with reality and kind of taking like a very logical approach to those and saying, well, you know, if I feel like I'm just the worst person ever, that can't be accurate because I know that there are other people who are worse than I am. Like Hitler, you know, other people have been worse than I am. Exactly. Like, you know, when you, because when you look at it that way, it's like, well, I can't be the worst person ever because there've definitely been people who have been worse than me.
I know. I haven't even met everybody. How am I supposed to know that?
Yeah, exactly.
It's an odds game, really.
Yeah. So just finding different ways to pick at those automatic thoughts. And then what the therapist does with that is they look at those thoughts and they try to identify patterns between them. And then in therapy, they'll talk about those patterns and maybe the fallacies behind them and how you, the client, can avoid thinking in that way and like get out of those thought patterns, with the goal of eventually having long-term attitude change. So a little bit later on in our interview, Ms. Broadwater is going to talk about psychoeducation, and that's just a method from the cognitive model that focuses on teaching the client about something or other to better inform their opinions on things. So some examples of psychoeducation might include the therapist teaching the client about pathways in the brain or statistics on cigarette addiction if you're trying to get away from cigarettes. But what Ms. Broadwater talks about in the interview is some research from two people, two researchers, one being Kristen Neff and the other being Brené Brown. So Kristen Neff's research stems a lot from this same idea of unconditional positive regard. So it takes that concept and spins it inwards. So rather than thinking the therapist should have unconditional positive regard for the client, it makes it even simpler and says you should have unconditional positive regard for yourself. And she calls that self-compassion. And we're going to have some links to some exercises and examples of this. But a lot of what it comes down to is being kind and supportive and gentle to yourself. Understanding that the mistakes you make are just like the mistakes everyone else makes. And then being aware of your situation and thinking about it clearly, which is, like we said earlier, a big thing in the cognitive model. Like being able to see yourself clearly and free of illogical patterns. And if you want to know more about Kristen Neff's research, there's going to be an infographic and a link to some exercises that kind of explains and then gives examples of how you can apply self-compassion practically and the effects that it can have on your life.
Right. And another part of the psychoeducation that she does is informing clients of the work of Brené Brown. And she does a lot of research about shame and vulnerability. And she has this awesome TED Talk called The Power of Vulnerability, or Power of Vulnerability. And then she actually just had a Netflix special release. So that is a very cool, easy thing to access. You don't even have to go to our show notes to check it out. Or she talks about how the willingness to be vulnerable, put yourself out there, you know, and how it transforms the way that people live, like taking risks and showing empathy, showing that you're a person, just like everybody else, can have some really profound impacts on your life. And so she kind of uses those ideas, Miss Broadwater, kind of incorporates some of those ideas of courage and vulnerability into her practice as well. And now we present to you the first half of our interview with Miss Andrea Broadwater. So we're here with Miss Andrea Broadwater, who is a licensed counseling professional. Ms. Broadwater, can you tell us a little bit about your background, your education? How did you get to where you are today?
Yeah, so I guess briefly, I'll just start with education. Yeah. So I have a bachelor's degree in psychology. So it's a bachelor's of science in psychology from Eastern Michigan. And then I have a master's in counseling psychology from City University in Seattle, which is a small not-for-profit university out there. And as far as background goes, I've been practicing since 2012. I've been pretty fortunate to have different roles within the mental health field. So I've been a crisis intervention specialist, which is actually for King County out in Seattle, and we would do mental health evaluations for kids within the Seattle, within King County. And I've also been a care manager and program coordinator for an eating disorder clinic, which is out in Seattle, but also around the U.S., and therapist. So I've sort of worn different kind of hats.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. What drew you to psychology in the first place when you were freshman at Eastern? When did you feel that spark?
I want to say, so I had a class in high school. It was the first time that I had taken a psychology class, and learning the little bit I did about the brain and human behavior, I was just fascinated, and I think it made sense a little bit of, you know, the family that I had grown up in, the dysfunction that I had seen. And so I think being able to have that click of like, oh, there's a reason for these things, you know, there's a reason for behavior, there's a reason for what I went through, sort of, and trying to understand that. So I think that Yeah, I think the assumption in my freshman year, I did not know what I was doing whatsoever. But I think I got pulled toward psychology because I was fascinated with human behavior. And I think, again, just trying to make sense of my own story and knowing that I was able to thrive in the face of adversity, I really wanted to be able to do that and help other people do that. And so that is what drove me to, you know, this is the direction I want to go with my career and be able to help others. So that was really the spark, I guess. Yeah.
No, exactly. That's definitely the same thing for me. It definitely brings a more, it's kind of cool to be able to see it go sort of full circle, you know?
Yes.
Taking what you learned from your own experience, and maybe do you find yourself using your own experience when you're with clients to kind of get on their level?
Yeah, I think when it's appropriate. So, you know, self-disclosure, you want to make sure that you're not sort of processing your own stuff while you're with a client, right? Like, it's their time. But when it's relevant, and I think when you maybe feel that a client is feeling alone in their situation, I think certain self-disclosure can be really helpful in them knowing that it's actually, you know, maybe a really normal feeling that they're feeling, or it's a situation that, you know, you've lived through, or you know other clients that have lived through those things, and knowing that you can get through this. So I think that, you know, it's something where people, it's a way to build rapport, I think, as well, because I think without disclosing anything about yourself, it's hard for people to build trust.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's a balance of, like, if I'm not making this about me, right? But yeah. We also, you know, we're human and we've all been through things, you know.
Okay. So then kind of taking it back to your clients, who do you see in your practice, and why is it that they're coming to therapy?
So I see a lot of different people in my practice. I think, you know, for as far as like what I specialize in, you know, I have some unique specialties as far as like eating disorders and trauma. And I think a lot of people come to therapy because they don't know how to make sense of their world. I think that that's just sort of a human condition, and we're all looking for answers. And so, I think they might come to therapy to try to fix themselves in order to sort of make, you know, sense of their world. But I also hope that when they start therapy, they sort of start understanding that there isn't anything for them to fix, right? And I think that it's more about understanding their behavior. It's understanding our behavior as a whole, so that we can sort of like make sense of like little pieces and stuff, and sort of accept what we can't make sense of. So that's my primary goal with clients, is to get to a point where we're sort of getting up to a place of self-acceptance and self-compassion, and sort of realizing like there's not that many things that like I need to change. It may be like little behaviors here and there that aren't helpful, but knowing intrinsically that like I'm okay, that I'm like acceptable, I'm lovable, I'm all these things. And that may be the first time that they're ever thinking that or realizing that.
So what does a day in the life look like for you?
Oh God, it depends on the day. I mean, I would say the days that I'm seeing clients, I usually start later in the day than probably most people, just because I usually see clients in the evening. So I might start my clinical day, you know, around 11 and, you know, stop around 7:30, 8 o'clock after all my notes are done and everything. I would say where it's different than maybe somebody's sort of like 9-to-5 job is that you're working the whole time, right? So if you see, let's say, 6 or 7 clients throughout a day, and I would say probably 5 or 6 are more likely where people feel comfortable. I mean, those are six solid hours of, right, interacting with somebody, using that like mental, you know, and emotional capacity towards people to help them figure things out and absorb information and absorb emotions. And and you might have, you know, a few minutes in between to like eat and, and do your notes and those kind of things. So, I mean, I think it can be sort of like you're hopefully, for me, I try to be really conscious of where I'm scheduling people and, you know, not having 3 clients in a row that are talking about complex trauma issues and being conscious of my own fatigue around that, because you take a lot on and that can impact the work that you do with clients and so really trying to be conscious of that.
So piggybacking off of that, a question that I had was, how do you practice self-care when you're, you know, it seems like a very emotionally exhausting mm-hmm. kind of work? How do you take care of yourself?
I think as something I've learned through years of practice, and I would say that, you know, doing private practice is, it's a different emotional exhaustion than, you know, working with families in crisis. And not that you don't get that in private practice. I would say it's maybe less often. But I think when you learn throughout your career that balance of how much do I need to take on in this situation? How much am I, you know, sort of like, what am I responsible for in this situation? Because I think early on in your career, and I think in the mental health sort of system right now, you know, in the news and everything, we like mental health sort of gets blamed for a lot, mm-hmm. right? Every time there's something that happens, a shooting or something, it's mental health. Why didn't they do this thing? You know, and it's a chronically underfunded system. But and so I think that's where a lot of people sort of veer towards private practice, is that you do have a lot more control over the clients you see and how many you do, you know, how many you see. And a lot of that, I think, goes back into self-care of like, I can only see 5 clients a day and be, you know, not drained at the end of the day, or I can
be present with each one.
Exactly. Because you really want to give each client your all, right? In that session, like that's the only thing that matters. And so, you learn those things about yourself. And I think that it's hard when you're first starting out, and especially depending on the job that you have, you know, for crisis response, there were days where I worked 15 hours and I was going back and forth from hospitals to schools to people's homes. And
Wow. That's
a lot more intense than, you know, where I am now. And it's a different responsibility, where if I'm doing a mental health evaluation for somebody in the hospital who may need to be, you know, may need to go inpatient or not, I'm, you know, working with other providers to try and decide that. And you feel a lot of responsibility for them and their well-being. Because if you say, I think this person can go home, I think they're going to be safe.
And then they're not.
And if they're not, right? But it's that following night where you're just hoping that that person's going to be safe and their family is going to be able to keep them safe. And not that that doesn't happen now. And I would say where that's similar is that when you're in private practice, right, like all of that responsibility just lies on you. There's no organization. There's no, you know, clinic that's behind you. It's this, my client needs to be safe. How do I make sure that they're going to be safe? And can I make sure that they're going to be safe? So it's a different type of stress. And for me, it's a lot of it has to do with how do I transition from one place to another? So how do I contain my work at work and transition into home life and be able to give all of myself to my home, to my family? A big part of for me is keeping my own journal or my own process notes. And so, you know, having a space where you can really process out what's going on for you and what came up in session and those kind of things, I think is really important. But I do think as far as self-care, it's just like anybody, where you need to find what works for you. And for me, you know, it's yoga, it's meditation when I remember to do it. And I think also having just a profoundly supportive partner, and my son, who's 13 months old, and I can be entirely present with him. He doesn't allow you to do anything else. So, right, he is amazing to watch. And so I think that the part of that self-care is, like, being able to be present with other people is, like, I get to share in my life with you guys. Yeah. And I think that that's huge in self-care, right? Yeah. It's not, like, when I come home, it's not just about me. It's, you know, everybody right. else that's here, so...
So you're able to set that boundary and, yeah, leave it at work, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so what does a typical treatment plan look like for a client?
I think it really depends. I mean, I think I'm very biased toward, you know, I hate treatment plans. I think most providers would tell you that. I think... I get it. I get that it's sort of like this sort of needed thing in keeping us focused, keeping us sort of on track. I think where I have conflict with it is that, again, I don't feel like clients need to feel like they are failing at something.
Yeah.
And I think that the interactions I've had with, no matter what the client was there for, whether that was for, you know, they were in a crisis and we're trying to get them out of a crisis, or I'm, you know, helping somebody through their trauma. I mean, I think sometimes the goal-oriented treatment can backfire. Yeah. I think especially when you have clients who tend to have, you know, perfectionism traits, you know, I think it becomes sort of a distraction from the actual content, because how do you turn, you know, your treatment plan, which is supposed to be sort of like SMART goals, right? Measurable. How do you turn, you know, self-acceptance into this measurable goal? And so I think what ends up happening is a lot of providers, including myself, is sort of like, how do I sort of manipulate these words into sounding something measurable?
Yeah.
When, you know, in my practice and the most success that I've seen out of clients is ultimately their own self-report of feeling better, right? Or their behaviors that aren't helpful have sort of been able to take a back seat because they're only focused on, you know, being present in their lives, being mindful, being able to actually enjoy themselves because they're not overconsumed with, you know, how many calories did I eat today? Or I'm going to have to get in a swimsuit and I can't face that. Like, they're able to be with their partners and create meaningful relationships. And so I think, like a lot of things in the mental health world, it sort of has become this necessary evil of, you know, insurance is going to pay for this and they need to see that something's working. And I believe in the evidence-based practices. I also think that I believe in my clients' own view and their own report of what is happening in their life and what do they want to focus on. And that doesn't always align with insurance being the driving factor.
Yeah.
I guess going off of that, then we've heard a lot from a lot of different people about diagnoses and how those can be helpful, can be harmful. Like, what do you think about the value or potential harm of assigning like a DSM-5 diagnosis to a patient or a client?
I think it depends on the situation. I think it depends on the client. I've seen it be really beneficial in sort of like helping the relationship sort of know, you know, the therapeutic relationship know where to go. Where do we focus, right? So if you have a client who maybe has a bipolar diagnosis or you're thinking that they have a bipolar diagnosis and maybe they go to a psychiatrist or a psychiatric nurse practitioner and, you know, they talk about it, maybe they get on medication. Sometimes it's they get on an antidepressant and they start to have a manic episode, you know. So I think it's one of those things that I've seen, you know, especially with like that diagnosis, where it has been really helpful because it helps to make sense of, you know, I had a break with reality, and now I know it's because I was in a manic episode, right?
Yeah.
And I think it depends on how you also approach it. I think if you pathologize the diagnoses and say they're evil and they're, you know, if you have a diagnose, you have a diagnosis, then this means all these things for you. I think a lot of people can even take it on as an identity.
Yeah.
And so I think it really comes from, like, how do you view human behavior? How do you view mental health? And are you coming from a place where you're pathologizing and trying to fix everything about the client, or are you coming from a place of, like, what I would tell clients is that this is just information. This is one part of you. This is just really how your brain chemistry, right, is interacting, you know, with the world around you. And so if you can learn how your brain processes things, then maybe we can go from there on how to manage your world, right? Yeah. And maybe you just happen to have one of those diagnoses that work better with a medication, you know, whether it's I have chronic depression or chronic anxiety, and having a medication really helps me, you know, it's more of just like helping us get to a path that works for that person. And is the diagnosis going to help us do that? Whereas I've had it where, you know, diagnoses just follow people around. And, you know, I think especially like borderline personality disorder, where that then is stamped on, if you see that on anybody's chart, there is already this this sort of like, I am not working with this person. It's like hot potato. Like, I don't want to work with this person. They have BPD, and there's no way that I'm going to meet with this person because they're going to be crazy and, you know, unreliable. And I think it's so unfortunate because these are people that need help just like anybody else.
Yeah, and they're trying.
Yes. And they require love. They require connection. And somebody stamped a diagnosis on them that is so stigmatized in our world that even mental health providers that are supposed to understand this are challenged by it, right? So they don't want to work with them. And part of that's a good thing, because you don't want to work with a provider who feels uncomfortable working with you. But I think it's one of those things that, like, it can be a good and bad thing, I think. It just depends on how you view it and how your client views it, right? Like, if it's a self-fulfilling prophecy of, like, you know, I have BPD, so I have to act this way or whatever. Or having BPD might, you know, just alert to your provider that, hey, I need to be really, really conscious of my boundaries with this client, you know? So, very dependent on the client and the provider, I think.
So we've heard some things about mindfulness and things about self-acceptance. So how would you define your theoretical orientation, and what does that look like when treating a client?
So I would say, I mean, the thing that I'm most trained in and the thing that I believe that it's helpful. So I'm trained in cognitive behavioral therapy.
Okay.
And trauma-informed cognitive behavioral therapy. And so it's, I mean, it's this huge theory that just, you know, has been inputted into all these other therapies. So, you know, dialectical behavioral therapy is also a cognitive behavioral therapy. So it's this whole relationship between the brain and, you know, your thoughts and your feelings and your emotions, and more recently connecting the bodily sensations as well, because it doesn't just happen cognitively, although a lot of us would like to stay there because it's safer.
Yeah.
We also have to integrate our body and our emotions. And so I think as I've become a more seasoned therapist, I've taken that to how to apply that individually with clients. And so CBT generally will have a lot of homework. People are not fond of homework, right? And so I think that I will approach it in a way of, you know, giving people homework, seeing what works for them, seeing what doesn't. I'm definitely not that person again. Like, I don't want somebody to feel like they failed at something. So if they didn't get homework done, okay. Right? Like, if you didn't do homework, that's you. Like, the homework is for you. I think sometimes there's this relationship, like, you know, I'm an authority figure and I gave this person homework and they were supposed to do it, and then they fail. They feel like, you know, I think guilty because they didn't do it. And ultimately it's, this is an invest, therapy is an investment in you. And so if you do it and you don't do it, it does not impact me at all.
Yeah.
It doesn't, right? We may not have that to review in our session, but that doesn't mean that, you know, all is lost and we can't move forward.
Yeah.
And so I think I pull a lot from just sort of that being able to process. I want people to really be able to identify their emotions, which I think a lot of us struggle with, because there's the stigma of emotions that we're not supposed to have them. We're supposed to be able to control them. Mm-hmm. And we can't. We have emotions whether we like them or not, and they're super complex, and we can have 15 different emotions all at one time and different intensities, you know? And so I think that I spend a lot of time with my clients being able to actually identify emotions, because like I said, especially in, you know, intellectual human beings, we want to stay in our frontal lobes where we can process things and we can make sense of stuff. And there's just so much information in our bodies and our experience that I want to be able to connect those things. And so I think there's a lot of awareness with emotion that we lose out if we're only focusing on the thoughts. And going back to, like, how are all of those things affecting my behaviors, you know? So I would say that's my theoretical orientation, but I definitely pull from, like, Brené Brown's research on shame, resilience, and Kristen Neff's research on self-compassion. And I definitely pull from those things, and we'll use exercises from them for my clients to do. So it's not just worksheet homework, right? Yeah. Somebody might journal, somebody might read something, you know, so it's really finding this place of curiosity and just finding what works for these individuals.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and when we were talking a little bit earlier, you brought up that you really enjoy reading about neuroscience, mm-hmm. and then integrating that into your practice. So yeah. What does it look like balancing that with all the cognitive, behavioral, emotional side of things?
So I would say, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy can be a very sort of like sterile, like, you know, do this thing and here's the CBT triangle and how are these connected? And I think you can have neuroscience informed cognitive behavioral therapy where, you know, if we're talking about our thoughts and emotions, you can talk about, you know, your brain of where are these things happening in your brain, right? So which part, and, you know, people, especially in trauma, a lot of the psychoeducation that you do initially is, you know, how is the amygdala and the hippocampus, how are they impacted by trauma? And how does that feel then, you know, as it moves into the limbic system and then more into our frontal lobe, how is it moving through and how is it informing, right, each of those functions? And so I think that neuroscience can be so empowering to clients that, like, it's like my brain chemistry, right, is impacting my behaviors. Because I think as a world, we just take so much, I mean, we should take accountability for our actions, but I think that we, it can sort of normalize somebody's experience by understanding their bodies.
Yeah, being like, this is a concrete problem. It's just like, and maybe even if they are somebody who comes in and feel a little bit more stigmatized about having a mental health issue, do you feel like it helps them see, like, oh, it's just like if I had a broken arm
or cancer, or whatever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can see people sort of let go of how much guilt or how ashamed they feel about having, you know, any type of mental health issue. I would say especially with eating disorders, it's something that in our world, the only time that people really ever talk about it is when it's in a movie.
Yeah.
Right? And it gets portrayed as something very different than what people actually experience. And so I think that it can really normalize people's experience to know that this is not something that you asked for. This is not something that you were like, hey, yeah, I really want an eating disorder. Let's do that.
Yeah.
Where it really is there's this thing happening in my body. And, you know, of course, environmental and genetics plays into it. But again, it's understanding what parts of your brain are affected by it. And of course, like the research, it's the eating disorders definitely need more research, but they are finding more things out about the brain and how it's affected, and sort of trying to find out the, you know, chicken before the egg sort of situation that's happening. But I do think that it can help people not take on so much of the, I guess, the personal responsibility they feel for having that disorder, right? Where somebody getting a mental health disorder is as much their responsibility as getting like cancer or something else, you know?
Absolutely.
Thank you again, Ms. Broadwater, for coming on and talking to us about all of these wonderful things. And we're really looking forward to hearing the rest of it next time.
If you like our podcast, or if you don't like our podcast but you like lying, give us a great review on iTunes or wherever you're listening. Like our Facebook page and make sure to subscribe so that when we drop our episodes, you can be one of the first people to know.
Yep. Give us a follow on Twitter, shoot us an email, and all of these things are, as always, in the description. So tune in next time for the second half of our interview with Ms. Broadwater, and thank you for listening. Just a big shout out to single moms, because single moms are awesome.
Yes. That's it. No context on the rest of the conversation.
Yep. That's all we need. Okay, yeah. Moving on.